Hello, and welcome. Welcome to the Mike Lazaridis Theater of Ideas here at Perimeter Institute. My name is Greg Dick. I'm the Director of Educational Outreach, and it is my sincere pleasure to welcome all of you here today. And a special welcome to our online audience. We are webcasting around the globe. And as part of the online, we have an online social media room at the ready. Dr. Damian Pope and a team of our master's level students, the PSY students, are behind their keyboards, ready to engage in an online conversation, answer questions. If you want to be part of that conversation, just use hashtag brainstem. All right. Then what? Brainstem. When you came in to this public lecture, you saw the main floor has been transformed. It's been transformed into the Brainstem Your Future Is Now Festival. The festival is designed to highlight the deep scientific discovery, those amazing technological innovations that that leads to, and then encourage everyone to imagine their future in this scientific and technological world. But in fact, this festival is actually part of an even broader initiative that started almost 2 years ago. It began with an unconference. We brought together the very best YouTube science content creators, world-class educators, and entrepreneurs, and we stuck them in a room for 2 days and had a two-day thought incubator. The results of that incubator kickstarted the main initiative of this Brainstem, the whole Brainstem package, which is a grade 10 careers course module for the Ontario curriculum. It takes students and it lets them consider what skills they need for the 21st century. Creativity, critical thinking, entrepreneurial thinking, collaboration, and it connects those skills to the STEM disciplines, science, technology, engineering, and math. That resource will be shared across the province and beyond, and done in part with our Perimeter Teacher Network. That has already begun. This summer, we had a special training weekend where we brought our network to Perimeter and got them familiar with the resource, and they've already started doing workshops and sharing with colleagues across the province. Also, as part of the initiative, there's a very special I Wonder Why video contest in collaboration with TVO Kids. So, if you have young children ages 4 to 11, have them ask a science question via video to us, and if they're fortunate, we're going to pick some of those questions and have our scientists answer them. Those questions that receive answers will be, both the question and the answer will be shown on TVO Kids over the following months. Plus, there's cool prizes like telescopes and science kits to be won. And then all of this is now the public celebration of the entire initiative is our festival. And with more on that, I would like to call Peter Braid, Member of Parliament of Kitchener-Waterloo, to the stage.
Thank you very much, Greg. Good afternoon, everyone, ladies and gentlemen. It's always great to be here, to be back here at the Perimeter Institute. As a Member of Parliament for Kitchener-Waterloo, I'm extremely proud that my riding is home to this world-renowned Center for Scientific Research and Discovery. And I'm also pleased today to welcome the Honourable Gary Goodyear, our Minister of State for the Federal Economic Development Agency for Southern Ontario, or FedDev Ontario as it's commonly known. Our government remains committed to creating jobs and growing Canada's economy. And we have seen great progress. Since the depth of the recent recession in July 2009, Canada's economy has created nearly 1 million net new jobs, the strongest job growth among G7 countries. And the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development recently revised its 2013 economic growth forecast, and Canada is now projected to lead the G7 in economic growth this year. This is due in large part to initiatives like our Economic Action Plan 2013, which focuses on the drivers of growth and job creation, namely innovation, investment, education, skills, and communities. We have faced some challenges in Waterloo, but our innovation ecosystem remains very strong. And our government is committed to supporting economic growth and diversification in this region. And one way we've been making a difference is through FedDev Ontario. Prime Minister Harper appointed Minister Goodyear as the head of FedDev Ontario in 2009 and reappointed him in July of this year. Minister Goodyear and FedDev Ontario are helping to build on our region's strengths and create opportunities for job growth and long-term prosperity across Ontario. And now I'd like to welcome Minister Goodyear to the podium for a special announcement today. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I am very excited to be back here at the Perimeter Institute. I have to tell you, it's a thrill to kick off the Future, Your Future is Now program. C'est un grand plaisir d'être ici avec vous aujourd'hui. Ladies and gentlemen, the Perimeter Institute, as you well know, has lined up a number of exciting speakers and educational events for the week, starting with one that you will hear just shortly from Dr. Grime. But the very fact that you are here today with us means that you already understand the vital and important role that science and technology and innovation play, not only today, but also into our future. They are indeed absolutely essential to helping not only Southern Ontario overcome its challenges, but by extension, the entire nation proceed forward. Now, because despite solid job gains since, as Peter was saying, July 2009 at the depth of the economic downturn, and some other pretty significant and impressive statistics, the truth is that there remains some uncertainty in the global economy, and frankly, far too many Canadians still remain under or unemployed. That's exactly why the federal government has kept the economy and job creation as one of our priorities, and Prime Minister Stephen Harper has mentioned this many times. It's also why, as Peter has mentioned, our latest budget, Economic Action Plan 2013, has chosen to focus on the drivers of job growth and economic growth. All of this, of course, underpinned by a commitment to keep taxes low and balance our budget. It is indeed through the Federal Economic Development Agency for Southern Ontario, or FedDev, that we are working very hard to meet the challenges and overcome some of these challenges here in Southern Ontario. We are, in fact, committed to building and helping businesses and communities innovate, adapt, and grow with the understanding that fresh and new ideas, science and technology, research, development, and commercialization are the building blocks of long-term economic stability and prosperity for all of us. And enabling a culture of innovation in our people, in particular in our young people, is quite essential. I'm sure you would agree. We recognize that to fuel innovation and technological development, young people need to explore the benefits of pursuing an education, even a career, in science, technology, engineering and mathematics, or as we prefer to call them, the STEM fields. So friends, by investing in the STEM fields, we believe we are creating a stronger economy, more future opportunities for value-added jobs, a new generation of entrepreneurs and inventors and business leaders, and of course, an improved quality of life for all of us. That's why, ladies and gentlemen, I am thrilled to be here this afternoon to launch the Perimeter Institute's Career Moves. I'm very proud to tell you that FedDev Ontario supported the Perimeter Institute and helped make the Career Moves and this week's BrainSTEM Festival a reality. This is indeed an exciting new educational resource designed to show young Canadians the potential that exists in the STEM fields. Now, last December, my colleague, Member of Parliament for Kitchener-Waterloo, Peter Braid, standing right here beside me, was here to announce an investment of up to $1.7 million to allow the Perimeter Institute the ability to enhance its educational outreach programming, help to reach students, teachers, and families throughout Southern Ontario, but by extension, the entire nation, and indeed, in some cases, right around the globe. These lessons helped focus on critical thinking, careers, and entrepreneurship in the STEM fields. Ladies and gentlemen, in closing, I can assure you that at the federal government's level, we know that the future of Southern Ontario, and indeed all of Canada, depends on an economy that is responsive to market needs and is able to promote and implement ongoing innovative practices and policies. We want to ensure that our children are choosing the STEM fields when they go on to post-secondary education and eventually on to very rewarding careers. And I know that Career Moves will help achieve this. I know that this will be just another example, a great example, of the Perimeter Institute's outstanding work in showing youth what can be achieved through science, technology, and innovation, now and in the future, which in fact is right now. Congratulations to the Perimeter Institute and everyone involved in Career Moves, and thank you all for being here to celebrate this great week. Thank you and merci.
Thank you very much, Minister Goodyear. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Michael Duchesne. I'm the Chief Operating Officer here at Perimeter Institute. Welcome to BrainSTEM. We have at Perimeter been extremely fortunate since day one to have the partnership of the Government of Canada, the full support of the Government of Canada. Perimeter has been built on a very, very successful private-public partnership, and the Government of Canada has been a major, major ingredient in that partnership. We have also in this region been extremely fortunate to have two members of parliament who really get what we're trying to do here, really get what we're trying to do in research and training and outreach. And so on behalf of all of us at the Perimeter Institute, I'd like to thank Minister Goodyear, thank Mr. Braid, thank the Government of Canada, thank FedDev for helping us to grow what's going on at this institute. And in fact, on behalf of all of you, because you are sitting here courtesy of FedDev and the support of the Government of Canada, thank you very much to Minister Goodyear and Mr. Braid. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael, and thank you, Minister Goodyear. And now, it's time for the special presentation. Let me introduce Dr. James Grime. Dr. Grime is a mathematician and public speaker as part of the Mathematics Millennium Project out of the Cambridge University in the UK. He spends his time traveling the world, giving talks on the mathematics and on the history of codes and code breaking. He's here today to share the real innovative thinking of Alan Turing, whose ideas arguably changed the course of World War II. I've been looking forward to this for months. Dr. James Grime.
Right, okay, well, I guess I'll start by saying hello to everyone. Hi, everyone. Hello, hi, it's exciting, isn't it? Right, let me introduce myself quickly. I'm James, and I've been invited here to talk to you about, well, Alan Turing and this thing down here. If you don't know who Alan Turing is, Alan Turing was one of our great 20th century mathematicians. He was a mathematician, he's father of computer science, and he was a World War II code breaker. And in World War II, this is what Nazi Germany were using. Oh, there we go. So they were using something called the Enigma machine. So you can imagine in World War II, you've got secrets you want to keep, so you would send these secrets in code. And this is what the Germans were using to send their secret messages. And that's what I've got over here. This is it. This is an original Enigma machine. This was actually used in World War II. This is currently 77 years old. There aren't many of these left in the world today. They're quite rare, and this is one of the few that travels around and gets shown off. So I'm going to show you that in a second. I'm building up to this. We're coming to this. So this is what the Germans were using. They thought it was an unbreakable code. But if the Allies can break this code, and by the Allies, I mean Polish code breakers, British code breakers, and, well, if I have time, I might mention the Americans. The American code breakers, depends. The British code breakers were working here, a place called Bletchley Park. Bletchley Park was halfway between Oxford University and Cambridge University, because that's where they took these code breakers from in those days. It was halfway between, and it was full of very clever people. So there were people like me, they were mathematicians, but they were engineers as well. We're talking early computer science. But they were just people who were good at languages, people who were good at puzzles, people who were good at games, people like that. It was a very difficult code to break. There were 10,000 people working at Bletchley Park. By the end of the war, it was a massive operation. Like I said, the Germans did think this was an unbreakable code. It must have been incredibly frustrating to break this code. So if I'm right, what's coming up next should be a picture of my impression of what it must have been like to have been a World War II codebreaker. That's what I think. Because it must have been. But if we can break this code, yes, we can read all these secret messages, and that's what happened. So there were, like I said, 10,000 of these code breakers. Unfortunately, I'm guilty of not talking about most of them. In particular, there was one that has a very close connection to Waterloo, and I will talk about him later. But I am guilty of just talking about one of them then, so I will just be talking about Alan Turing in the main. And Alan Turing designed this machine called the bomb machine to break these codes. It's a massive machine. You can see how big this machine is. Big, noisy thing as well. It would rattle around. And this machine could help you now break the code in 20 minutes, which is pretty good. For the 1940s, it's pretty good. So in principle, on a good day, you could get the code in, you could break it, you could send it out to the Allied general, and you can do all that faster than the original message was received by the German general. So the Allies would know what was happening in the German army before the Germans did, which is a slight advantage, you can imagine. In principle, at least, we can do that. So this is the plan. I'm going to give you a history and a biography of Alan Turing and the Enigma machine as well. So let's do it. Let's get straight in. So last year was the centenary of Alan Turing's birth. He was born in 1912. There he is. Look at him. Bless him in his little sailor suit. His parents, well, his father was a civil servant. His mother came from a family of engineers. They spent a lot of time in India, and he spent a lot of time in Britain being raised by friends and family who did not necessarily encourage his scientific interests, which is a shame. But only a few years after the birth of Alan Turing, the Enigma machine was born as well. Well, kind of. So only a few years later, in 1915, they started to experiment with this idea. You see, at the beginning of the 20th century, it had become possible and necessary to mechanize codes. So before this, you would be doing pen and paper methods. And the problem with pen and paper methods when you're trying to send a secret message is either they're too easy to break. So you might look for the most common letter, that's E in English, or some tricks like that, they're very easy to break. Or if you use a more complicated code, it just becomes a pain to use. So what they needed was a machine that could do you a complicated code for you. So in 1915, the Dutch Navy started to experiment with these sort of ideas. They didn't really capitalize on it, though. And this idea reached a German engineer called Arthur Schirbius. So in 1918, he patents his idea for the Enigma machine. And they started to produce these things. There you go, they started to sell them. This is the first version of the Enigma machine, Enigma A. And it works pretty much like a typewriter. You would type your message in, and it would print off a code for you. There's a little notch at the front of that machine, little notch, and you can go click. And if you type in the code, it would then print off the decode for you, or decode it for you. There's also another little setting at the front as well, so you can go click again, and it would just work like a typewriter. So you could, it was just office equipment, and that's what they would do. They would sell these to businesses, to banks, places that need to send secret information. It didn't sell very well. It was expensive. And the idea eventually reached the German Navy, and the German Navy started to use it. Now, while all this is going on, unknown to Alan Turing, and I'll drag the story back to Alan for a second, Alan Turing starts to attend school. There he is in his school uniform. Alan Turing started to attend a pretty posh school called Sherborne School. It's in Dorset in the UK. And he didn't have a particularly easy time at school, I'm sorry to say. What I've got to show you are Alan Turing's school reports. So this is Alan Turing's school reports. There you go. This is from his housemaster. He has good brains as any boy who's been here. And they're good enough for him to get through even useless subjects, such as Latin, French, and English. I think it was Alan who thought these subjects were useless rather than the housemaster. His maths report, not much better. This is his maths report. Not very good. He spends a good deal of time apparently in investigations in advanced mathematics to the neglect of his elementary work. His work is dirty. And this is from his headmaster. And for a little bit of translation, what we call a public school in the UK, you might call a private school. This is from his headmaster. I hope he will not fall between two stools. If he's to stay at public school, he must aim at becoming educated. If he's to be solely a scientific specialist, he is wasting his time at public school. I always imagine him saying that while holding a pipe as well. Wasting your time. So not having a particularly easy time. However, he graduates and he starts to study mathematics at King's College in Cambridge. Now, again, I'm going to sort of drag this story off again. I'm going to drag it back to the Enigma. So while Alan Turing's at school, the German army are now using the Enigma machine. The following year, 1929, the inventor of the Enigma machine, Arthur Scherbius, he died in slightly bizarre circumstances, at least today. His horses bolted while he was driving a horse-driven carriage. So it's kind of sort of a 1920s car accident. The company continues without him. And in 1930, the next year, they start to produce a military version of the Enigma machine. So it's called Enigma I or Enigma 1. And that was just for the military. And that's what this is here. This is an Enigma I right down here. Now, the story of this one that I'm going to show to you, this was made in 1936. So just a few years later. What I was told is that this machine was found after the war. It was found by an American cryptographer. He took this home as his souvenir, I guess. And when that cryptographer died, this machine was sold. And it was sold to a man called Simon Singh. I don't know if you know Simon Singh. I'll show you. This is the guy who owns the machine now. There you go. There's Simon. That's not a magnifying glass, by the way. He just has one really massive eye. Simon, he's an author, he writes popular science books. In particular, he wrote a book called The Code Book, which is all about the Enigma machine. It's a very good book. If you're interested, it's a very good book. But Simon here owns this machine. This is his machine. He owns it privately. He's lent it to us so that we can bring it in and show it off. So it is a special thing to have. Now, so that everyone can see what I'm going to do, and you may see I've got a setup here, so I should, in theory, be able to do this. Hey, right, good. Good, you're easily impressed, that bodes well. So, before I show you how this machine works, I must warn you, it is an old machine. Like I said, it is 77 years old now. It can be temperamental. When you're 77, you're allowed to be temperamental, okay? Yeah, you can do that too, right? It can be a little bit. So if that happens, I'm getting my excuses in early, you'll know why. It is an old machine, but I think it will be working. So fingers crossed, let's take a look. And there it is. And it's a beautiful thing. There it is. It's a beautiful machine. It's 1930s styling. It's all black and silver highlights. It's all wood and steel. Very nice. Very mechanical. But let's see how it works. So let's say I send you a message. I'm going to send you a message in code. And it should be something in German, really. It should be something about Bratwurst or Schnitzel or something like that. Or Schadenfreude. But I'll keep it. I'll just say hello to you. I'm going to say hello to you, right? So I'm going to type in hello in the machine. Let's see how it works. So when I type in hello, I'll do the H first, and then I'll press H. There we go. Now, if you can see that, the letter C lights up. The code lights up. That's H becomes C. Let's do the Eve hello. E, there you go, becomes an I. So this is the code. L is an M. The second L in hello becomes a Q. And you finish it off, you do the O. And, oh, look, you get an M again. That's interesting. So that's the code. The machine doesn't transmit. It never did. It doesn't send anything. Someone has to stand next to it and write down the letters that light up. There is a reason it lights up. If you built it with a carriage, like a typewriter with paper, it made it heavier. It made it 8 times heavier. So that was the reason why it lights up, to make it portable. But you may have seen something odd about that. So the two L's in hello were two different letters. So old-fashioned codes, if you had double letters, they become double letters in your code. And for a code breaker, you can use that as a clue, helps you work it out. But this is different. No, a double letter might not be a double letter. If I do this again, if I press A, what have I got? I've got E there. If I press A again, I've got L, and it will keep changing. And there's no pattern to this. There's no way to know what it's going to be next. So you can see why the Germans thought they had an unbreakable code. I'll show you how this works. I'll open up the lid and I'll show you the inside. So you might see these in museums. There are a few. I did check. There's two in Canada, but now there's three. There you go. Now, if I open up the lid here, we can have a look at the inside. So not quite a typewriter anymore. At the top here, let me point some things out. First of all, I hope you can see there are 26 little light bulbs here in rows. And then we've got these three big wheels at the top as well. So those wheels are called rotors. And inside these rotors, it's full of wires. Right? And all the wires inside are crisscrossed. It's all like spaghetti inside, all mixed up wires. Now, let's have a look at what happens when I press a letter. If I press a letter, if you can see that, the rotors turn. Well, they rotate, which is why they're called rotors. So this one, boom, on the right-hand side, moves every time. Every time I press, it clicks. When this one on the right, when it does a full turn, when it does a full revolution, it will kick the middle rotor one place. You may have just seen that happen a little bit earlier. Let me see if I can do it again. I don't know when this is going to happen. So if I keep pressing, when it does a full turn, it will kick the middle rotor one. There we go. And then it will keep going. When the middle rotor does a full turn, eventually, it kicks the left-hand rotor one place. So you've got a fast rotor, which is going all the time, a middle rotor, and a slow-moving rotor. And it's kind of like you've got hands on a clock. It's like a minute hand and an hour hand and a second hand, kind of like that. Now, it's a very clever machine, but all it is, it's just a circuit. It's just a battery connected to a bulb. It's almost the most simple thing you can make. What I've got in this top right corner is the battery. This is a conversion there with the wires coming out of it. That's the battery. That's a modern battery we've got in there now. But when I press a letter, this battery connects to this bulb, and it lights up. All the wires for the circuit are inside the rotors there. But the clever bit is the wires move. So when the wires turn, the battery gets connected to a different bulb. So you get a different bulb lighting up. Let me do that for you. I'm going to turn these wires. And now the battery will connect to a different bulb. And it will do each time, because you're moving the wires. I might give you a better idea of that in a second. I might show you something else. Just to say, before I do that, these rotors actually come out. They can swap order. So you can swap the order of the rotors. Each rotor has 26 starting places. And I'll show you this as well. At the front of the machine, we have even more wires. There's more wires for the circuit. I pull one of these out. It's called the plug board. If you can see that on my hand there, it's like an old-fashioned telephone switchboard. It's like an old plug board or a patch board, and these wires connect letters up together in pairs. Now, let me try and show you this. What I've got over here is, great, an Enigma machine simulator. And you can find these on the internet. You can Google this and you can find these Enigma machine simulators and you can use them. And they work just like my Enigma machine down here. But if I do this for you, let's try one out. I'll press a letter here. I'll press G for no reason. And G becomes J. So G becomes J. Now, if I click this button here, I'm going to show you all the wires inside the Enigma machine. Now, if you remember what I said, inside it's full of crisscross wiring. So it might look complicated. Don't be put off by this. This is the insides of the Enigma machine. And it is. It's just full of crisscross wiring. But if you can see what I did, if you can follow that yellow line, I pressed G. So when I pressed G, the path of that yellow line, it goes through the Enigma machine, goes through the rotors, 1, 2, and 3. It actually loops back. It then goes through the machine again, backwards. It actually goes through it twice, goes through it again, and it connects to the letter J. And so J would light up. But if I keep doing this, let's say if I press G repeatedly, let's see what happens. So here I've got G becomes a, what was that? An S. G becomes an S. G becomes an L. If I keep doing that, it will keep changing because those wires turn and the path of that yellow line changes each time the rotor moves. And that's why the letter changes each time. But you might be thinking, how do you get the message back? How does this work? How do you get the message back again? Right, this is a good bit. Right, let's try this. I'm going to show you how to get the message back again. So let's do one more message then. If I switch to the camera. Let's see. I'll keep it short. I'll say hi to you. I'll go, hi, how you doing? So I'm going to say, hi. I'm going to send you that message in code. So let's do that first. Let's do the hi. So H first. So that's a T. And I for hi is a W. TW is your code. So someone would write that down. They would then transmit that message by radio. That would travel by Morse code, by radio. And then miles away, maybe on a ship somewhere, miles away, you've got a second German officer. And they're listening to this radio signal, and they're writing down the code. And it's TW. They're writing that down. Now, the second officer has an Enigma machine as well. They've got one of these machines. And their machine is exactly the same as the first one. It's set up exactly the same. There is something I have to do now. When I typed in hi, this rotor on the right, it moved. It moved two places. So I'm going to have to reset this machine back to where it started. I'm going to move this rotor back two places. So that just resets to back to where it started. Now I'm going to type in the code instead. I'm going to type in TW. So if I type in the code, T, T becomes H. And if I type in W, W comes I. I. And you get the message back again. It's very clever. It's absolutely brilliant. Yeah, very clever machine. Brilliant piece of engineering. So it's a code and decode machine. If you type in your message, you get a code. And if you type your code in, you get your message back again. Now, like I say, you've got these two people here, each with an Enigma machine. They're miles apart, and they have to be set the same. How did they know how to set their machines the same? So that was written down for you. If I switch back again. The settings were written down for you on a big piece of paper. It was actually a big monthly sheet of paper, and the settings changed every day of the month. So it changed for each day. I'll show you what it looked like. Big code sheet. Looked like this. And on the left-hand side, if you can see that, that's just the date. We've got 31, 30, 29, and so on. That's just the day of the month. Let me run through how this code sheet works. So you've got the date on the left. That first column with the Roman numerals, it's your rotors. I said there were three rotors, and they can swap order. They were just called rotor 1, rotor 2, and rotor 3. And there are six ways that you could arrange those three rotors. So let me do that. So there are six ways that you can arrange those three rotors. This second column here, this Ringstellung, this ring setting it's called, this is something I've not talked about. On the outside of the rotor, they are labeled with 1, 2, 3, 4, or maybe A, B, C, D. So they've got labels on the outside of the rotors. Those labels actually turn. You can shift those labels, they rotate as well. So each rotor has 26 ways to adjust its labels. If you change that, it's going to change your setup. So you need to know where those labels need to be. So each one has 26 places to arrange it, 26 for the first one, 26 for the second one, 26 for the third one. You multiply that together, the total number of ways you can set those ring labels is 1,576. Now, this third column here, these pairs of letters, what we've got here at the front then, that's the plug board, and that makes pairs. So this pairs of letters here, this column with pairs of letters, are the instructions for setting up the plug board. So those are you putting your pairs together. You actually had six pairs of letters at this point. You would make six pairs, and the total number of ways that you can make six pairs of letters out of the alphabet. This is the biggest number. They were quite pleased about this when they added this. It is this number, which I think is 100 billion. Yes, 100 billion ways that you can set the plug board at the front of the machine. The final column, it's called the ground setting. That's pretty much the rotor starting position. So each rotor has 26 starting places. 26 for the first one, 26 for the second one, 26 for the third one. So total number of starting positions is again 17,576. If you want to know the total number of ways to set up this machine, you would multiply that together, and the total number of ways is about 10,000 trillion. There are 10,000 trillion ways that you can set up the Enigma machine. They were quite pleased about that. So you can't check them all. It's not possible. Now, if you've understood most of that, I hope, then fantastic. Phew. There is one more thing I need to tell you, because there is one more thing. You see, there would be dozens or hundreds of these Enigma messages being sent every day. And if they were all being sent using the same key, the same setting, then that would be bad security. That would be a very bad idea. So they didn't do that. Each message actually had its own secret starting position. For the three rotors, they all had a secret starting position for each message. Let me show you how they sent that secret starting position. So, first of all, they would set the Enigma machine to the ground setting. That was written down for you on that sheet of paper. So you would set that. So let's say the ground setting is XYZ. You'd set your machine to XYZ. The operator could then pick his own secret starting position. And maybe the operator chooses to pick ABC. It can be different for every message, but let's say he's picked ABC. He's got to send that secret in code, and that's what he would do. He would send it to the other guy in code at the beginning of the message, and he would use the Enigma machine itself to encode those three letters, ABC. So he would type that into the machine. In fact, he would do it twice. Actually do it twice, so ABC, ABC. And it would turn into six letters of code. In this example, I've got JTE, QGL. So you've got six letters of code, and he puts that at the beginning of his message. At the other end, the other guy with the Enigma machine would then use his Enigma machine to decode those six letters, and he would get ABC, ABC. And then he would know that that's the secret setting for the rest of the message. And so each message had its own secret starting place. Phew. Right, yes. It is complicated. It is. So, if we can break this code, like I say, it is important. The first people to break this code was actually the Polish. The Polish were doing this first. So the Polish knew that Germany was a threat and already started breaking this code. They started in 1932. This is one of the Polish code breakers, Marian Rzeczewski. And this was a kind of a turnover point. So before this, code breaking was for people who studied classics, people who could do puzzles. But this was a technological problem. And it needed a technological solution. And this is really the start of when they started getting engineers and mathematicians and scientists in to be code breakers. So Marian Rzeczewski here was one of these young mathematicians, and he set up a series of mathematical formulas, mathematical equations, to work out the wiring inside this Enigma machine. Without seeing the Enigma machine, just from the code, he'd set up a series of equations. However, he needed a little bit more information. to put into his equations, he needed one of those code books with these instructions that come with the Enigma machine. He needed to steal one of these code books. He needed help. He needed help from a spy. He needed help from this guy. This is Hans Tito Schmidt. Now, Hans Tito Schmidt, he was from actually quite a well-to-do German family. Hans, however, was pretty much down on his luck, and he had a brother who was a general in the German army. So his brother got him a job. And part of Hans' job was to destroy these secret Enigma code books. However, instead of destroying those code books, he would sell them to the French. And then the French would give them to the Polish, and Wojciechowski said, fantastic, brilliant, that is just what I needed. He used those code books, he used the information in those code books, he put it into his equations, and he was able to work out the wiring inside the Enigma machine. Like I said, without seeing one of these Enigma machines. And then they could build their own. So by 1933, they were building their own replicas of the Enigma machine. Now, that's only half the problem. You see, so the machine was never really the mystery. This is not the mystery. The other part of the problem is the secret setting. These settings that change every day, that's the other half of the problem. That's the difficult bit, and that's what they would have to do every day, trying to find what these secret settings are. Now, if I can, well, I'll tell you what, to be brief, during the 1930s, this is a battle. Between the Polish code breakers and the German code makers, there is a battle going on. The German code makers would increase security, and then the Polish code breakers would have to break that code, and then the German code makers would increase security, and then the Polish code breakers would have to break the code again, and this is going on through the whole 1930s. Until Wojciechowski then designs a machine called the Bomba. There it is, there's a sketch of it there. So this Bomba, I don't know if you can see that, there are six places where you can stack Enigma rotors. So it's like six simultaneous Enigma machines going. And you would have one of these Bomba machines for each rotor order. So there were three rotors, and there's six ways you could arrange those three rotors. So you would have to have six Bomba machines. Some say it was named after a type of ice cream. Some say it's named after the ticking noise that it used to make. Some say it was just a good a name as any, it'll do. You did have to have one for each order. So the problem was, again, it is this battle. And the very next year, in 1939, the Germans increased security again, and they added two extra rotors. So now the Germans were using three rotors, but from a choice of five. They would have a box of five rotors. You pick three from five. Now, to pick three rotors from five, there are 60 ways you can do that. So what they needed were 60 Bomba machines, one for each order, and they couldn't do it. They didn't have the resources to stretch to that. So the Polish got in contact with the British codebreakers, and they had this secret meeting in Poland in Kabaki Woods. There's this secret meeting between the Polish codebreakers and the British codebreakers, and the Polish passed on their ideas and these replicas that they had made. And the British continued their work after that. Now, in a very unsubtle way, I'm going to sort of drag this back again. All through the 1930s, the Polish are trying to break these codes, successfully as well, doing very well. But Alan Turing was at university at this point. So he graduates from university in 1934. He starts doing his master's degree. And this was when he decided to tackle one of the great unsolved problems of 20th century mathematics. So at the beginning of the 20th century, a German mathematician called David Hilbert had set a series of challenges for 20th century mathematics. And part of these challenges was this thing called the decision problem. Now, well, I'll try and give you the idea. There may even be people here who are familiar with the idea, but I'll try and give you the idea of this problem. What David Hilbert wanted to know was there a general method, an algorithm? Was there a general method for determining whether a mathematical statement was true or false? That would be very useful to know, if there was a general way to tell me, is that true or false? And Alan Turing decided to take on this problem. To solve this problem, Alan Turing conceived of a hypothetical machine. And this was a hypothetical machine that would do the job of a man. Now, he called the machine the computing machine. He called the man whose job it replaces, he called that the computer. And this is the start of computing science today. And Alan Turing proved the result as well. He actually proved it in the negative. There isn't a general method for determining whether something is true or false. And these machines are now called Turing machines. And this is before he went to do his PhD. This is about when he's 22 or 23 years old. He publishes his paper in 1936. He then attends Princeton University. He returns to Britain 2 years later, and he starts working part-time for the British Codebreakers. And also, and I think this is interesting and important to point out, Alan Turing would also publicly support the asylum of German and Austrian Jewish refugees into Britain. And I think that is interesting and important. I think it does show that Alan Turing wasn't just involved in this in an intellectual way. He was involved in the war politically as well. He was taking an interest. Now, the very next day, the very day that war is declared, and the very next day, Alan Turing reports for duty at Bletchley Park. And Alan Turing is put in charge of something called Hut 8. Hut 8 was in charge of breaking the Navy Enigma code. You see, the Polish methods were working well for the Army codes and the Air Force codes. But the Navy were doing something different. They were actually sending those secret settings. If you remember, I talked about sending secret settings in code at the start of the message. The Navy were actually doing that in a slightly different way to the Army and the Air Force. And the Polish had tried to work out what that method was, and they hadn't succeeded. They couldn't do it. So this was an open problem for Alan, right? This was a problem that he could have all to himself, and he was delighted by that. He said, fantastic, great, he could solve this problem. Again, to solve this problem, he did need the Navy code books, these instruction books that come with the machine. So again, they needed to find a way to steal these Navy code books. So they needed to come up with a plan. This is the guy who came up with the plan. This is Ian Fleming. This is the author of the James Bond books. Ian Fleming was the assistant to the head of naval military intelligence in World War II. He's pretty high up there, and he knew that this was a problem they were having at Bletchley Park. It was Ian Fleming's responsibility to come up with a plan to steal these Enigma codebooks. This is Ian Fleming's plan. Right, I'm going to tell you Ian Fleming's plan. Right. So, step one. Steal a German bomber aeroplane. Right, now that's step one. Right, I don't know how he's going to do that. Saying you can steal one of these to then fill it with the toughest men you can find, the hardest, toughest men you can find. Then to wait for a bomber raid to come over the UK. When a bomber raid comes over, to take your fake bomber aeroplane and to ditch it into the English Channel. As it had been part of the raid, but had crashed. You then send out a distress signal when a German ship comes to help, to then leap on the ship, kill the crew, hijack the ship. And they nearly did it as well. They nearly did it. So they got the bomber aeroplane. I still don't know how they did that. They got the bomber aeroplane. They got the crew. They went down to Dover on the coast. They were waiting. And what they were waiting for was for the right type of ships to come by so that they could do this. And the right type of ship never came by. And in the end, the operation was cancelled. But it is fascinating, isn't it? It does give you this idea of where he gets his ideas from for espionage and thing. And you know, his ideas for things like, no, not Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, for things like From Russia with Love, particularly From Russia with Love. If you know your James Bond, From Russia with Love, it's about James Bond stealing or negotiating for a Russian code machine. And it's basically a thinly veiled reference to Enigma. Now, it was disappointing that this was cancelled. I've got a quote here about Alan Turing. It comes from one of the other code breakers at Bletchley, who said, Turing and Twin came to me like undertakers cheated of a nice corpse. Oh, what a shame. All in a stew about the cancellation of Operation Ruthless. Now, although it was disappointing, other missions did end up getting these Enigma materials. British missions, one Canadian mission, so I'll throw that in, one US mission actually ended up with these Enigma codebooks. And then we could use them and start breaking the Navy Enigma code as well. Now, let me just take this story. Now, this is a nice time, I think, to talk a little bit more about Alan Turing. Alan Turing did have a reputation as being a little bit eccentric. He was known as the professor at Bletchley Park, and he's 28 at the time, but apparently he has this professorial air about him. There are stories of him riding his bike into Bletchley Park while wearing his gas mask to protect him from hay fever. And you can imagine with all the tubes coming out of his gas mask, it looks like an alien just cycling into work. There are other stories of him. He would chain his coffee mug to the radiator so no one would steal his coffee mug, which is usually told as a story of how eccentric he was. Seems perfectly fine to me. Seems like a good idea. I don't see any problem with that whatsoever. There are other stories of him. He bought two bars of silver, and he buried them. He actually buried one in the woods, and he buried another bar in a stream, and he wrote the location of these bars of silver in code, which he hid under a bridge. When he came to find them, couldn't find them. Never saw them again. Couldn't find them. Other stories. Now, this is something that a lot of people don't know. Alan Turing was actually a very talented long-distance runner. He would actually run for meetings from Bletchley Park to London, which is 60 miles. It's unbelievable, yeah. And I think it shows something about Alan Turing as well. It's kind of a single-minded thing. I guess it gives him time to think. His marathon time was only 11 minutes short of the world record at that time. This is not the result of a casual hobby. And he was seriously considered for the 1948 Olympics. Here's another story, which involves Winston Churchill as well. This is the story of Action This Day. You see, in 1941, the code breakers at Bletchley Park were really suffering, again, from lack of resources and lack of staff. So Alan Turing, totally ignoring protocol, going over the heads of all his bosses, wrote a letter directly to Winston Churchill, complaining about the lack of resources at Bletchley Park. To his credit, Winston Churchill then writes to his staff saying, action this day. Give these guys everything they want, top priority. And I think that does show something about Winston Churchill as well. He personally supported these codebreakers' effort. He was very interested in what they were doing as well. This was also the same year, 1941, when Alan Turing proposed to one of the girls who worked for him at Bletchley Park, a girl called Joan Clark. She was a mathematician as well. The engagement didn't last very long when he confessed that he was gay. And it didn't come as a surprise to her, apparently. She wasn't shocked. He was openly gay, pretty much, by that time. And you may have heard what happened to him after the war. After the war, he was arrested for being gay. It was illegal to be gay in those days, so he was arrested for being gay, and he was treated very badly. He lost his job working as a code breaker because he was a security risk. He was barred from coming back to the United States because he was an undesirable type, and he was put on hormone treatment. And in the end, he did, I don't know if you've heard this, in the end, he did commit suicide. He did lace an apple with cyanide, he took a bite out of it, and he poisoned himself. Would you believe me then if I told you that that's where the logo for Apple computers comes from? Which is the apple with the bite? No, it's not true. Oh, I thought I'd have you there. Oh, no, you're too clever for me. Right, I thought I'd reel you in. No, you're not paying for that. Okay. No, it's a myth though, right? So if you hear someone tell you this in the future, right, you've got, yeah, did you know Apple Computers, Alan Turing, Apple taking a bite out of it, right, you can tell them it's not true, right? If they ask you how you know, right, you just tell them a mathematician told me, right? Now, I'm going to drag this over to the bomb machine. This is the machine that Alan Turing designed to break the code. Like I say, they were using Polish methods as well, but the Polish methods were fragile. And what they really needed was a method to break the Enigma code that was a little bit more robust. So if the Germans decide to change their procedures, which was likely, if they decide to change their procedures, they wanted a method that would continue to work. So this is what Alan Turing did. And he designed this thing, the bomb machine. Now, I'm going to try and tell you how this machine works. Now, this is my slightly technical bit. So I know what it's like, right? 2 minutes after you leave this room, you will have completely forgotten everything I've said, right? That's fine, right? That's normal, right? So if you can understand what I'm saying as I go through the steps of how this machine works, then you've understood it, great. If you can get the gist of it as I go through it, brilliant. I don't expect any more, but let's have a go. So I'm going to show you how this machine worked. So first of all, they did find a flaw in the machine. Although the Germans thought this was unbreakable, they did find a flaw in the machine. You may have noticed as well, when I was pressing A earlier, I kept pressing A and it kept changing letter. Eventually, if I keep pressing A repeatedly, every letter will light up, except for one letter, A itself. A letter never becomes itself. And this is a clue. We're going to use this to break the code. So a letter cannot become itself. A is not A. B is not B, Z is not a Z. So you can use this to break the code. So what you're going to do is you're going to make a guess. You're going to take your code and you're trying to guess a word or a phrase that might be in that coded message. Now what the Germans would do is that every morning, 6 o'clock in the morning, every morning, they would send a weather report. And that was the same every morning. It was a standard format. It was the same every day, apart from the actual weather. It was a standard thing. So you knew what that said. So we're going to take a phrase from that. I'm going to guess, let's say, weather report. So I'm going to use that. Or in German, Wetterbericht. So I'm going to use that phrase, Wetterbericht. And I'm going to look to find where it fits in my code. So I'm just going to slide that word underneath the code. So it might look like this. So you see in the middle there, I've got a code. You can't read it. But underneath, I'm sliding my word of Wetterbericht. Now I know that a letter can't become itself. So if you can see that there, if you move that word, Wetterbericht, one place to the left, if you can see, you would have two T's matching up, and it can't fit there. T can't become a T, so that doesn't fit. If I moved it instead one place to the right, you might see I would have two R's matching up. Again, not allowed, doesn't fit. But this might work. Where I put it here, this might work. I've got no matching letters. It's a guess, but maybe this is where the Wetterbericht fits into my code. Okay, I'm going to use that guess. What they did next, and this is not too important, but I'm going to show you. What they did next is they actually drew this into a diagram. Again, don't worry too much about it. It was called a menu. It was a diagram of this. What they did, if you can see, in the first place, we've got A becomes W. In the second place, we have T becomes E. And in the third place, Q becomes T. And you would draw that as a diagram. It looks like this. And that's, in fact, those two things are the same. Those two things are the same, so don't worry. But if you can see, in the first place, A becomes W. In the second place, T becomes E. In the third place, Q becomes T. They just join those letters together. Actually, it turned out that diagrams like these with cycles in them were better diagrams, were better guesses. But that's not too important. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to try and work out the plug board at the front of the machine. If you remember that plug board connecting letters in pairs at the front. Actually, during the war, you were using 10 pairs of letters, 20 letters connected into 10 pairs. We're going to try and work out what the plug board setting is for that day. Now, you've seen my simulator, and you've seen the real thing. I'm going to show you a very simplified version of the Enigma, even more simplified. So we're going to use my guess, my Wetterbericht. In particular, I'm going to use that second position where T became E. So remember that. If you remember the second position, T became E. I'm going to use that. Here's my simplified Enigma machine. All I've done is I've turned this into a big magic box. So it looks like this. So when I press T, it goes through the Enigma machine like a big magic box. T goes through the machine, and E comes out the other side. T becomes E. What I've split it up into is the plug board, the rotors, which I've combined into a big box. Then you go through the rotors a second time, and out comes E. That's my simplified version. Now I'm going to make one more guess. I'm going to guess one of the plug board settings. So for no reason, I'm going to make a guess, and I'm going to say T is connected to A on the plug board. So that is a guess. T is connected to A. But let's see what happens if that's true. If T is connected to A, well, then it will go through the plug board. I will press T, it will go through the plug board, and it will become A, because T is connected to A. Then A will go through the rotors. Now, we know how the rotors are wired up. We know the insides of these rotors. We know how that's wired up. So all we need to do is pick a position and send A through. And let's see what happens now. So we're going to pick a rotor position and then send A through the rotors. And let's say P comes out the other side. So P comes out the other side. However, this is helpful. This helps me work something out. Because if P comes out the other side, then P goes through the plug board and becomes E, which means P is connected to E on the plug board. And you've learned something about the plug board. You can work out one of these plug board settings. P is connected to E. You just do that over and over again. That Wetterbericht, I can do that over and over again. I'm going to do this a few more times, get a few more plug board settings. So there you go, same idea, just a few more times. The first one is the one I've just done. So that was P connected to E. The second one, you go through the same process. I've got K connected to Q, I've learned. The third one, I've discovered X is connected to B. And on the fourth one, when I do the process, I've discovered that T is connected to G on the plug board. The fourth one is a problem, though. I don't know if you can see, but the fourth one is a problem. I've discovered that T is connected to G. But I started by assuming that T was connected to A, and it can't be both. It can't be connected to A and G at the same time. So there's a problem here. TA and TG can't both be plug board settings. Something's gone wrong. One of my guesses is wrong. It's my first guess here. This T connected to A, that is wrong. I got that wrong. So you just do it again. Try a different setting. Make another guess. Try T connected to B. If that doesn't work, you try T connected to C, or connect to D, or Z. You do the whole alphabet. You go through all the 26 options for a given letter. It doesn't have to be T. You go through all the options. If none of them work, it's your rotor position that's wrong. And you go click, and you try the next rotor position. Yeah, and that would be hard to do. Let me just summarize that. So if all your guesses are wrong, you pick a letter like T, and if all your guesses are wrong, then it is the rotor position that's wrong, and you go click, and you try the next rotor position. There are a couple of ways to speed this up. This would be hard to do, especially pen and paper like that. A couple of ways to speed this up. Alan Turing had this idea. First of all, he worked out that once you've found one of these contradictions, you can actually reject all other logical deductions. So when I did that up there, I had a few deductions. I had T connected to G, which was wrong, but I had other things. I had P connected to E, and K connected to Q, and X connected to B. Those are all wrong. You can reject them together at the same time. Those can all be rejected at the same time, and they don't have to be checked. Those can all be eliminated together at a stroke. So this is a process of elimination. It's actually a little bit backwards, but it's faster to do it as a process of elimination, and they all go together. Another way to speed this up is that all deductions can be made instantaneously with electrical circuits. And that's what the bomb machine was. The bomb machine was like a big Enigma machine, like 36 simultaneous Enigma machines. You put in your guess, TA, T connected to A, you would put that in. And if the electrical current flows through TG as well, it goes wrong, and you go, error, this is a mistake, and you would check the next position. But it would also flow through all those other deductions as well, again, instantaneously, and those don't need to be checked. And again, that can all be done straight away. And then you can check all the rotor positions in under 20 minutes. And that's how the bomb machine worked. And again, don't worry if you didn't get all of that. Again, if you got the gist, or if you could follow most of those steps, you're doing well. Again, you'll forget everything I've said. It was a good job that they did build these machines. They started building them in March 1940. The first one was called Victory. And a few months later, in May 1940, the Germans did change their procedures. They actually stopped doing this repetition. Do you remember that ABC, ABC? They stopped doing that. And that means all the Polish ideas, which were based on that repetition, stopped working. And from that point on, they were using Alan Turing's bomb machine to break Enigma codes for the rest of the war. Now, I could stop here. There's a couple of things to tidy up just before I stop. We want to see what happened to the remaining players in our story here. So, first of all, you may have heard that the U-boats were using four-rotor Enigma machines. That might be something you've heard of before. And you might have been sat there thinking, why doesn't he talk about the U-boats? So they did this in 1942. So not straight away. They added an extra rotor. Again, this increased security. And the Allies were locked out of the code. They were locked out of the code for 10 months. Bit of a disaster, until eventually they did work out a way to break this code as well. Alan Turing wasn't really involved in that. He did work out the wiring for that new rotor, but he wasn't really involved in that. This you may have heard of, and this was something that I mentioned right at the start, which I'm now going to come back to. You may have heard of something called Colossus. At Bletchley Park, they had this other machine as well, not just the bomb, but this thing called Colossus, which was also breaking German codes. But it wasn't breaking the Enigma code. It wasn't breaking this one. It was actually breaking a different German code machine called Lorenz. And Lorenz was a machine that was being used by Hitler and the top level of the Nazi party. This was an even more secure machine, an even more difficult code to break. That code was actually broken by a man called Bill Tutt. Now, he has a strong connection to Waterloo because after the Second World War, Bill Tutt came and worked in the maths department at the University of Waterloo. And he lived here for the rest of his life. He lived here. And he broke the Lorenz code machine. And we could read these top-level secret messages. And a man called Tommy Flowers built this thing called Colossus, again, to break these Lorenz messages. The other players that you may want to know about. We had Rejewski. He was the Polish mathematician. Rejewski, eventually, he did escape to Britain, and he continued breaking Enigma codes in Britain, but breaking Enigma codes for the Polish government. And even though these Polish code breakers were in Britain, they did not talk to the British code breakers, which is odd, I know. Hans Thilo Schmidt, the German spy, he was found out and he committed suicide as well. They did find him out. Other players? Well, we've got the Enigma machine, of course. What happened to the Enigma machine after the war? After the war, the Allies started to collect up these Enigma machines and they started to sell them to foreign embassies. And they would say, "Hey, do you want to buy an Enigma machine? They're really good." Ask the Germans. The Germans swear by it. So we were selling a machine we could break. This is what espionage is really like. Alan Turing, what happened to Alan Turing? In the later part of the war, he became a consultant. He wasn't actively involved in the code breaking. He actually was trying to build a speech encryption machine called Delilah. And that's really ahead of its time. That's really what the army are using now, speech encryption. The technology encrypts your speech for you. So you just talk into it. But he was trying to build one of these machines. After the war, Alan Turing then worked in Manchester University in the UK. and he continued his work in computing, in artificial intelligence, and in mathematical biology as well. In particular, why do you get a Fibonacci number of spirals in a sunflower? That was something he was interested in. He was recognized for his work. After the war in 1945, he did get an OBE. The reason why he was getting an OBE was secret, but he did get an OBE, and it was important. His work was important. What I've got to finish with is a little quote from one of the other code breakers at Bletchley Park about Alan Turing. This is from Hugh Alexander, really his sort of second in command, who said, "There should be no question in anyone's mind that Turing's work was the biggest factor in Hut 8's success." He says Hut 8 there. You could say Bletchley Park as well. In the early days, he was the only cryptographer who thought the problem was worth tackling. Other people had given up. He was still trying to break this code. It is always difficult to say if anyone was absolutely indispensable, but if anyone was indispensable, Alan Turing was. Now, I will finish with this. Winston Churchill was a big fan of what these guys were doing. As a whole, all the code breakers at Bletchley Park, he was a big fan of them. What he said was that the code breakers were the geese that laid the golden eggs, which is a slightly strange thing to say, I know. He was probably drunk at the time. I think what he means, though, is these secrets that they're finding out, breaking these codes and these secret information, it's just so valuable, like golden eggs. But, he said, the code breakers never cackled. They never spoke about this. This was all top secret. After the war, they had a big bonfire at Bletchley Park. And all those machines as well, they were destroyed by order of Winston Churchill. They were all pulled apart and all destroyed because it was top secret stuff. If I tell you the truth, I think a couple of those bomb machines were spirited away in secret to be used. But even those were recycled and used in other machines as well. In better machines, I hope. But it was important to break this code. Historians reckon that these guys shortened the war. And they say they shortened the war by 2 years. There's Winston Churchill agreeing with me, right? 2 years, right? And in doing so, these code breakers, they saved lives. And these guys aren't soldiers. And they're not fighting around the world like other people were. But it is an example of using your brains to save people's lives. It's brains over bullets. And in lieu of a better punchline, I might leave it at that. Thank you.
That was terrific. That was terrific. Thank you. Thank you. That's a great job. Wonderful. Oh. Okay, we will open the floor to questions for Dr. Grime. There's a microscope pinned right here.
So they can look at me very closely.
They can look at you very closely through that. Just speak loudly into the microscope. Microphone. Please just queue up so I'll be able to keep track of how many questions are coming. And we will also want to broadcast your pretty smile as you ask the question. So get close and ask the question.
Hello.
Hi there, Professor Grime.
Hi.
So you said that by, was it 38 or 39, they had picked 10 pairs of the set?
Yes. Switches.
What did they do with the other six? Were they permanently set, or did they have just like strange surrogates?
Yeah, so the other six would not be swapped with another letter. So we got 10 pairs of letters. So if I say A is connected to T, A would get swapped to T, and then T goes through the machine. The other six that are left unpaired don't get swapped, but they do get scrambled inside the rotors. Now, there is a reason why they were picking 10 pairs of letters instead of 13. Although it might sound quite odd, the greatest number of combinations, the greatest number of ways that you can connect letters in pairs at the front of this machine is actually 11. Why they didn't use 11, that's a good question. I don't know. They used 10 as a round number. I don't know. But 11 has the greatest number of combinations. 12 and 13 actually dips. The number actually gets more restrictive, and the number of combinations actually goes down. If you want to think about it, you can. Just do it with a fewer number of letters. Try it with the first four letters, A, B, C, D. Try and connect four letters into two pairs or into one pair. I think with two pairs, you would have three ways to do it. And I think with one pair and two left alone, I think there are six ways to do it. So you would get fewer when you get to a certain point. And the greatest number of combinations was 11. Yeah. Thank you. No, it's a good question as well.
Fascinating. You said that the Poles were working on decoding the code in, I think you said 1931.
Yeah, yeah.
What was the impetus to get them started doing that so far before the war started?
Well, they already knew that Germany was a threat. I mean, there was already, politically, that was going on. So they needed to know, well, as countries do, they need to know what other countries are up to. But the Germans were using this, which was considered unbreakable. And so with this technological problem, they said, well, who are we going to get in? We'll ask these young mathematicians with their bright young minds to tackle this problem. And amazingly, they started to make progress on it. And they did a survey at one point to see how well they were doing. And at one point, they were breaking 75% of messages. Not all, but 75%. It's amazing, I know. Hello. Hi.
I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how these codes, once they were broken, were used so that the Germans were kept in the dark about the fact that it was broken.
Yes, yeah. So it might be, you might know, but you would have to use this information wisely. You can't act on every piece of information you get. You can't sink every ship that you know about because it gives away that you've broken the secret code. And then they would change it, and that would be a disaster. And so there is a moral question in there. Because there are people who you could evacuate or save, and you can't, because it would give it away. And Winston Churchill did have this policy that, you know, winning the war is more important than winning the battle. So there is this moral aspect to it as well.
Thank you. Let's take one more question.
Hello.
Hello.
So you mentioned with the Enigma, you could use 26 characters of the alphabet.
Yes.
What about the punctuation and white space?
Yeah. Just to repeat that, yeah, why didn't the Enigma machine have spaces and punctuation? I think, to make it simpler, other versions of Enigma did have punctuation. So office versions, the business version, did have punctuation and things like that. The military version was very stripped down. No German letters. No numbers. Numbers were spelt out. Punctuation had sort of a code of its own. An X was a full stop. A Y is a comma. J's were quotation marks. So there's a sort of a code there in itself. And again, it's just to strip this down to make it as simple as possible. And I guess that makes it lightweight and portable.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. James Grime.
Thank you very much.
Fantastic. You can just take a seat and write it back to you. Thank you. That was terrific. Truly terrific. I would also now like to acknowledge some of our partners that are really helping put this together. So first, TVO, our media presenting partner, they've been absolutely terrific, and they're bringing this live around the globe. So thank you, TVO. And then Eclipse Productions and Tidal Productions are responsible for this beautiful look, this set in here, the unbelievable activities outside, and they've stitched it all together for us. So to Tidal Entertainment and Eclipse Productions, we couldn't do it without you. Thank you very much.